Okay.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Operating Systems. I find it very funny that an operating systems course starts off with issues with technology. It's like, come on, I rebooted it. Shouldn't that do something? But, oh, wait. No. I'm just trying to, just checking. Forget it. I have a chalkboard which is kind of low and kind of small, and I have a little bit of pink chalk. Is it really all I have is pink chalk? Actually, there's a whole thing of colored chalk, which is not bad. I can't complain about that too much. But so I have to apologize having the course outline was online a bit late last night, so you might not have found it. If you go to the main SCS list of outlines, there's a link to the main webpage. The outline is not uploaded there because it's on my wiki and I still have to add the TAs to it, so it seemed silly to put a PDF there that I'm gonna have to upload and change. But if you Google for my name, so, Anil Somayaji, if you might know, in computer science, there's two Anils. That was pretty weird when I came. It was like, what? There's already one here? It's actually not that uncommon of a name in India, but. So, if you Google for my name and Google for operating systems, you'll find my wiki. The actual URL at the top level is, scs.wiki. So homeostasis.scs.charlton.ca/wiki. But if you search for operating systems there, it's been there for a very long time, so Google has no trouble finding it. And if you go to the wiki and you go to the page for fall 2017 operating systems, you will see a big page with a big calendar, and there'll be a link for an outline, and you'll see the outline there. I would put it up here, but I am stymied. So, but I will tell you the key points of the outline so you know what you're in for in this class. And I will use my computer here to make sure I get things right. So, first off, what's the grading scheme? What's the grades? So, we have 20%. 20%, 25%, and 35%. Four things. The big one is easy. That's the final. The 25 is also easy. That's the midterm. Now, one thing you should always do when you come to these courses is go like, where are the key dates? And so the midterm matters. So if you look at the outline, you'll notice I have placed the midterm after the fall break. So I've actually placed it on the Thursday after fall break, which is November 2nd, I believe. This seems to work well with the way I could structure things otherwise, because in the course we will have, the other two parts. So the midterm's November 2nd, the finals during the final exam period, and those when they'll schedule it. Hopefully not on Christmas Day, but you never know. And then we have assignments. There are four assignments. And there are eight tutorials. So the way I've structured this is that every assignment is related to two tutorials. So the pattern is you get two tutorials. The tutorials are Monday, Wednesday, so there's a Monday, Wednesday, and there's another Monday, Wednesday, and then the
following Monday, an assignment is due. And that assignment is based on the material in the two tutorials. So in the tutorials, you'll be playing with code. Playing with code relating to operating systems. We'll be hacking on it. You don't have to get anywhere specifically in the tutorials other than to spend your time and basically make a reasonable attempt at things. I mean, if it's really simple stuff, we'll say you should at least get to do this, because if you don't get there, you wouldn't be trying. But basically, it's a participation grade. So 20% grade, you should all get 100% on this. If you don't get 100% on this, you're just not trying. Not putting the time. And you might say, well, I overslept. I missed the tutorial. Now, one of the tutorials is Wednesday at 8:30 in the morning. So it's actually a kind of legitimate excuse. But there's another way to get credit for your tutorials, which is you do the work on your own and you go and talk to a TA and show them that you actually went through. Ask them some questions. So the TAs will all have office hours. And so when you go there, you can just say, I've done this work, and you're fine. So if you technically don't have to show up in the tutorials if you just like visiting TAs in office hours. But really, you want to go to the tutorials because it's nice because other people are there. You can ask them questions and stuff. Like, tutorials are supposed to be a collaborative experience. Assignments are supposed to be your own work. But each is only 5% of your grade. If you're really going to decide cheating and stuff, it's like, I wouldn't suggest it. But I'm not going to worry too much about it. Because, frankly, I'll nail you here. If you don't do the work, you won't be able to get 60% of your marks and you'll fail the class. So, in order to do the assignments, so the tutorials will have code, you'll be hacking on code. In the assignments, you'll be answering questions about code. You'll be showing that you understand the code. Because the thing I want you to demonstrate in this course is that you can understand the concepts and the implementation in operating systems. So a lot of the courses up till now, you'll spend most of your time writing code. Not in this course. You'll spend most of your time trying to figure out what the heck this code is doing. And any code you write, you'll be extending the code. But in extending the code, it will really be about, oh, I've just extended this, so now I understand what this piece of the code is doing. So that's the basic structure. The TA, you'll go to the TAs, ask, get their help. There's a lot of you. I have office hours after lecture. Not today. Not today. But in general, yes, Tuesdays, Thursday afterwards. Figured, not today. And I can set up appointments otherwise, but I saw about 212 registered in the class, so there's a lot of you. So make use of all the resources you have. But really, this course will not be easy. But if you put in the time, I think you'll get a lot out of it. So does this basic structure make sense? So the tutorials, you all should have signed up in addition to the lecture to one tutorial section. There are two tutorials on Monday, one on Wednesday. If you have to move around, like you say, I can't go to this tutorial on a given week, can you go to another one? Yeah, it doesn't matter that much, except there is limited seating in the tutorials. So if you come to a tutorial and it's overflowing with people, and you're not signed up for that tutorial, we'll have to kick you out. So try to go to your assigned tutorial. So that's grading. The class wiki will be where all the material will be. One thing I do normally is at least I record the audio of lectures. In lecture, when I use the computer, I'll also be recording the computer so you can see what I'm doing. And I will put those on my webpage. I don't upload them to YouTube, not so much because I don't mind them being public, but just because, why? You don't have to use Google infrastructure.
my little Mac Mini is more than enough to serve video on the Carlton Network to all of you. So it'll be on the class wiki there. And there also may be some notes. If you're interested in helping put up notes on the class wiki, so I'll be doing lectures. There'll be video recordings made of them, but some people would like to read or have like a more of a written record. I won't always provide that, but if any of you are taking notes and want to upload them to the wiki for a little bit of extra credit, talk to me, and you know we will. I have to amend the. Normally, I can add up to about 5% to your grade, but it requires you actually like basically. I can give you like 1-2% for every lecture that you do notes for. So contact me, we'll see how many people are actually interested in doing it. I'll probably have a TA manage it. So that tends to work out. So plagiarism, collaboration, let me be a little more specific. You can work together on anything except the midterm and final. You're explicitly allowed to work together on assignments, and especially the tutorial. But if you work together on assignments, acknowledge it. Give credit where credit's due. I want to know who you are working with, and it should be on the assignment. I do not want to see, oh, I did all this work, and actually you're working with five other people. If you're working with five other people, fine, but put it on there.
Would you recommend working with other people, or is it something you can do alone?
You should be able to do it on your own. But you may find that you are struggling with some of the material. In fact, you will definitely want to get help from others, particularly in the tutorial. When it comes time to the assignment, hopefully you can do it on your own, but you may, if you have to work with others, that is okay. But the reason you should be working with others is not a divide and conquer strategy. You should not be doing, I'll do this problem, you do that problem. It should be, I don't understand what's going on here. Do you have an idea? You both talk about it. Now you both understand. And then you can both do it. Because this course is all about understanding the concepts and then understanding details. We're going to be, so just to give you an idea, you're going to be coming face-to-face with a code base that is about 15 million lines of code. That's the modern Linux kernel. 15 million lines of code. I do not understand all that code. You definitely will not. I do not understand most of it. One of the key objectives I want you to have coming out of this course is that you get a handle on dealing with large code bases. And the key rule with large code bases is you don't know everything that's going on. You can hopefully understand a little bit about something, and your understanding is probably a bit wrong. But you do what you can, and you experiment, and you build up your knowledge enough to be able to actually make meaningful change. So, yeah, use each other. And so, what is going on? What you're dealing with that? How can I actually have a midterm and final about that? Well, I'm not going to have a midterm and final about all of that. I'm going to have a midterm and final about the code you deal with and the particular concept that we deal with. You will have fair warning. You will know basically what's on the midterm file. That doesn't mean necessarily you'll understand it. You'll only understand it if you've done the work. If you haven't done the work, sorry. But if you do it, I think you'll get a lot out of it. So that's so collaboration. So. Yeah. It's called, so why do we do this? I'm partially it's because I want you to, I think it's a good exercise to say, you know, people
you're getting ideas from sources, you should acknowledge the sources. The other thing I would like you to acknowledge is whatever resources online that you use. Because that can be very helpful for us, because you go like, wow, why are all these people getting this idea wrong? It's like, oh, they found this one stupid website. And this is particularly true in operating systems, especially relating to the Linux kernel, because the Linux kernel has been around for 20-something years? I don't think we're at 25, but over 2 decades. It's changed a lot in that time period. You will, if you go and just search for code and examples, then you'll find things for, you know, Linux 1.0. You know, it's and stuff that will not work. And in fact, is utterly wrong. So you have to be very careful about what resources you use in trying to understand things. So list your resources, list who you're working with. Because that helps us understand what's going on, and that also keeps you all honest. As you're going to draw upon resources. You're not going to do this all on your own. So let me know where it came from. I will get annoyed, and there will be consequences if people start turning in things like, oh, look, there's 20 identical assignments, and no one actually acknowledged that they were working together. I'm going to go like, that's not good.
So when you say like,
you won't be copying code because you won't be writing significant amounts of code for the assignments. The assignments are not about writing code. The tutorials are about writing code. The assignments are about reading and understanding and showing what you have learned. So, for the tutorials, you'll probably go like, I found this really cool trick. I did this, and that's worked, and oh, wow. Yes. So, there's no required textbooks for this class. There is a textbook that is available for free online, which I encourage you to read, and I will list chapters from it for reference. But I am not going to be teaching out of that textbook. I more will, and sometimes the things that I'll put there will not quite be directly relevant to the exact lecture, but it's a good textbook. It's got a lot of great material, but it's not exactly what I'm going to teach you. In the sense of, a lot of that textbook is more conceptual, and I will be covering the concepts, but I'm going to be grounding it out in code. Very messy code. So it's not there in the textbook. So I strongly encourage you to read the textbook, maybe even just read it, read chapters at once, or use it as a reference. You go like, I don't understand that concept, go and read the book. It's available for free online. You can also buy it by print on demand if you'd like a nice big paper copy. It's well written. I mean, I've used a number of operating system textbooks over the years, and this is honestly, it's among the best ones I've found, and it's remarkable that it's available for free online. So, if there was another textbook I thought was really significantly better, I would have recommended it, but this one is.
What's it called?
It's Operating Systems 3 Easy Pieces. And so the URL for it is, it's OSTEP. OSTEP. If you just Google for Operating Systems 3 Easy Pieces, you'll find it. There's a link under Required Textbooks on the course outline. And there's lots of links for the different lectures. So, textbook. Oh, and software. Oh, yes, I've got to talk software. Any other things. I'll just list the learning objectives. I'll say what I'm hoping for you all to get out of this. So, I want you to be able to write C code that uses low-level Linux services and should be able to implement, and you should be able to implement simple Linux kernel extensions or modules. You should have a strong conceptual model on how an operating system works that allows them to determine. I have to figure out the exact writing of my learning objectives. I think needs work, but
allows you to determine the relative role of applications and operating system code when debugging software. Understand the basic use of architecture of virtual machine-based cloud architectures. That last point gets to the software we're going to use. So all of you have used VirtualBox, right? We're not going to be using VirtualBox. Naturally. We're instead going to be using OpenStack. You all know OpenStack? So OpenStack, so if you're familiar with AWS, AWS, you know, or Amazon, or basically any kind of cloud service where you can basically rent a virtual machine. Computer science has their own clouds using a platform called OpenStack. On that, you will all get one or more virtual machines for you to play with. And the beautiful thing about using these virtual machines is they are persistent. Not backed up. You're gonna have to back them up on your own. So, and this will be important because some of the things you will do are hazardous to your virtual machine's health. So you do want to back it up. rsync is your friend. And I will show you aliases for how to do things, but you'll have persistent virtual machines where you can do your work. And you might say, but I like to work on my laptop and sometimes I like to know when I'm not connected to the internet. But, oh, come on. You work when you're not connected to the internet, really? If you do, fine, but then you can download, there's no reason why you can't run it locally. You can run these images locally, and I can explain how to do it. You can use VirtualBox or something. Running VirtualBox locally on your machine is a whole different thing from running it in the lab. Because you run it in the lab, the standard image, you log out, everything's gone. But if you run it on your own laptop, it's a persistent image. So you certainly are welcome to use that, but I'm going to make sure everything works on OpenStack, so that's a nice supported environment, and it will provide some nice benefits, especially if you have more than one machine that you use. You can access it from anywhere on the internet. You just have to VPN to the Carlton network, and from there you can SSH in. So, we're not expecting you to keep these virtual machines secure, so they're heavily firewalled off, but if you're on the Carlton network, you can access them fine. Have you all used the VPN on Carlton? How many of you have not used it? Okay. Look it up. If you have questions, let me know. We'll put it directly. But the Carlton, basically using your My Carlton One credentials, you can use the Cisco VPN client on any major OS. If you're on Linux, just use Open Connect. I think that's the one. Open Connect works really well. It's an open source. You say openconnectcuvpn.carlton.ca, but you have to find the PDF for the iPad. I can walk you through this later. Look into it. If you're running Linux, how many of you are running Linux now? 1, 2. Not many. You're going to play with Linux more. And one great way to get comfortable with Linux is to live in Linux. So I wouldn't suggest necessarily blowing away your laptop right now, but plan on spending time with it. I think you've used it in some of your past courses, but no, wait. In 2401, you guys used VirtualBox with Linux, right? So you've all used it. So you have used Linux, but you haven't used it. Anyway, we'll go through that. So one of the reasons why I want to use, another reason to use OpenStack is that it's the basis of all modern computing environments nowadays. Everything's going to the cloud, so you might as well get used to using cloud environments. And almost everything people use in the cloud is running Linux. Yeah, there are Windows things. Microsoft keeps pushing people. Why don't you do this? But let me give you an idea of how far Microsoft has gone to accepting the dominance of Linux in the cloud. You all know you can install Ubuntu on Windows, right? You heard about this?
Anymore.
Huh?
Ubuntu can't do it on Windows.
But what?
Yeah, yeah. It works. No, it's available. It's in the Windows Store.
Oh.
So you can install Ubuntu on Linux. Ubuntu Linux on Windows. But there's a little trick. It's not actually Linux. And you'll have to go through this course to understand what this is. But they're running programs for Linux without Linux. They actually implemented an interface compatible. They emulated Linux. They implemented the API. They basically said, we have to let people run Linux binaries. So you can run Linux binaries on Windows now.
Doesn't it run through an abstraction layer?
Yeah, but they implemented an abstraction layer. They have an abstraction layer, so you make a Linux system call, it's using Windows services.
That's not really virtualization, though. That's
no, it's a kind of virtualization. I mean, they say there's like three kinds.
Yeah.
OS kind of virtualization. But again, it's something we'll talk about later. But that's, they implemented the Linux ABI, the binary interface. That's crazy. Microsoft never used to do these sort of things. So, but of course, it's a new Microsoft.
Different from what I do. So, other boring things. Collaboration, textbook for software. If you need accommodations, I've gotten a couple of people asking for accommodations. Please get those in as soon as possible. The midterm, though, is a good whiles away, so I think most of the accommodations will have to do with midterms. In terms of absences and other things, I'm basically a reasonable person. If you deal with me reasonably and you have something that comes up, life happens, that's fine. But in general, what it means is you're gonna have to do the work still. Let's say you missed the midterm. Okay, you missed the midterm. Potentially, maybe I can find another time for you to do the midterm if I haven't given up the solutions, or maybe I'm gonna, or maybe you'll just have to have the final count for it. But I'll want a good reason. And I'm pretty good at telling what people are doing. But I don't know, it's not worth my time really figuring out if you're lying or not. At the end of the day, the grade you're gonna get in this course is whether you actually did the work or not. So, let's talk about operating systems, actually, instead of all this stuff. So, if you go to the course website and you look through it, you'll notice that I have a lot of links to a lot of chapters in the textbook, and a lot of red things, which basically means there's no notes there. That's because the notes aren't there, because things don't exist. Same thing for the assignments, same thing for the tutorials. Those will start appearing next week, particularly the tutorials and assignments. The first assignments, the assignments are due on October 2nd, October 23rd, November 20th, and December 4th. So those are Mondays. You'll have the assignment for at least a week before that. It'll be based on the code of the tutorials before that. So the tutorial weeks are not next week. No tutorials next week. Still got to figure things out with the TAs and everything. But it'll start the week of September 18th, September 25th, October 2nd, but not October 9th, because October 9th is a holiday. What holiday is October 9th? Wait. Oh, that's Thanksgiving. That is Thanksgiving. Okay. October 9th, that seems early. They actually don't even, wait. Is that Thanksgiving? So I guess that must be Thanksgiving, but anyway, so October 9th, Thanksgiving, no tutorial that week. October 16th and 18th, and then the next tutorials are in November 6th, because, of course, there's a fall break, and then there's the midterm. So no tutorials during the week of the midterm. So after that, then basically in November, you have 4 weeks of tutorials, and then we're done. I think that's all the structure stuff. So let's. I have yours. Let's start with the definition. An attempt at definition. Specifically, what's an operating system?
entire class is supposed to be about something. So we should try to define it, at least. Although a lot of the interesting things in life, you really can't define some of this stuff. You sort of know what we see. So what's an operating system? It's software, yes. That is a good thing to acknowledge. Operating systems are a kind of software.
Handles drivers and handles drivers?
Drivers? Yes, drivers are a part of operating system, but technically you could have an operating system without drivers.
It manages resources and other applications that run on it.
Okay, so we're getting to key concepts. Resource management. Big thing. Operating systems is the code on your system that's responsible for the resources. When I say resources, I mean things like RAM, disk space, like the display, mouse, keyboard, network. Things that the computer, the CPU, the operating system manages those resources amongst multiple programs. Because modern operating systems run many programs. The operating system is the program, or set of programs, that controls access, that manages those resources. That's, I think of that as half of what an operating system does. What's the other half?
The interface between computer user space and the hardware.
User space is certainly part of it. Although in principle you don't actually have to have that. That's a way we implement it. What I'm thinking of is abstraction. Which is that the resources that are managed by an operating system are transformed by the operating system. For example, a disk or a solid state disk or a hard disk or something, in hardware, the interface it provides to the rest of the computer is a linear sequence of fixed size blocks. A billion things, a billion 4K chunks, or something like that. I mean, and how do you access them? You use an offset, an index. Could you, in principle, write your code so it just basically indexed into a very large array of 4K blocks? Yes. You can. It's not very much fun, though. Normally, the first thing you'll do with that is put a file system on it, which is what a file system is for. So an operating system takes the resource you have and abstracts it in a way that makes it better. Because that gets down to what really an operating system is. An operating system is a set of code that turns the computer that you have into the computer that you want to program. Because really, given the hardware that computer designers produce, you don't want to program that directly. It's really not very pretty. So we stick this nice piece of software over it that controls it, manages it, and abstracts it into forms that we can program. Now, what kind of abstraction? Where do you draw the line? What sort of transformation? That depends. That's evolved over time. There's certain services that we know are, that's clearly the operating system. Other things we say, I don't know. Like, is a web browser part of the operating system? I mean, some years ago, that was a major point of litigation. Microsoft argued that they included Internet Explorer and Windows because it was part of the operating system. But in fact, you look at modern platforms, a web browser, embeddable web browser, is a common thing that's provided as a standard service on all major platforms.
Windows has it, Android, iOS, Mac, everyone has an embeddable browser, because it's useful. Is that part of the operating system? I mean, it depends on how you define it, but certainly in terms of computer that you'd like to have, because you end up programming to that browser.
Now we have entire application stacks. You all heard of Electron? think that's the that's the new one. Anyone heard of Electron? So there's a lot of like newer shiny apps that are coming out as part of the Electron platform. Like, if you have any of you use, you all use Slack, right? You know what Slack? So if you get the desktop client for Slack, I think it's written using Electron. You know what Electron is? It's Chrome. It's a web browser with stuff on top of it. It's a dedicated purpose web browser. It's a little heavyweight bring along. It's not Chrome, it's Chromium. But Chromium is the open source basis of basically all of Chrome. Chrome is just Chromium plus a few bits. So yeah, it's Chromium plus a little bit to help you like have a dedicated thing. It's kind of crazy. But hey, why not build an application in HTML, CSS, and JavaScript? That's what we do all the time on the web. Why not just do that on the desktop? We can have our discussion. But I'm just saying, in terms of what kind of abstraction we provide, it's not a clear thing. And when you think of things that are kind of ridiculous, when you really look at them, they aren't necessarily so ridiculous. And you're like, well, why is that any better than this other thing? You start arguing efficiency, you're going to lose. Because operating systems are pure overhead. You always do things faster from a pure execution point of view if you ditch the operating system. But nowadays you really don't want to because it's so much nicer. So this class is really about what are the resources, how are they managed, and how are they abstracted? What are the mechanisms by which this is done? And you might think this is like, you know, really new fancy stuff, but actually it's old. That's one thing about operating systems in some sense. It's an old subject. I mean, sorting is old in computer science. You know, there's certain things like, you know, that's old. But operating systems is also really old. Do you know when all the major concepts of like what we're talking about in this class were picked, you know, they were developed? Any thoughts? Where did they come from? Who built some of the first modern operating systems? What sort of organization? From the 80s? You know, Sun maybe or something? I don't know, maybe Microsoft did it or who did it? One of the main folks who did it was IBM. Good old IBM, and their contemporaries, Burroughs, and you know, and then there was things like Multics and stuff. But in the 60s, mainframes were where all these concepts were developed. And actually, the first motivation for this was having a big, expensive mainframe that you wanted to share amongst multiple people. Because you know, if you have a $20 million thing and you say one programmer can use it at a time, you know, the people who paid for that $20 million computer is going to be like, I think you all need to share. Can you share this somehow? You're all so smart and good at software. Can't you make it so that more than one person can use it? It's a really fast computer. Not fast by today's standards, of course, but pretty, you know, all these, you know, fancy-dancy resources, can't you somehow share? And so they created time-sharing systems. And the idea was for more than one person, typically programmers, to use the computer at the same time. And so they had to solve a fundamental problem, which is how do you keep those crazy programmers from messing with each other? You have to let them all run their programs. You had to run multiple programs. Those programs might be a little malicious. It's like, you know, in the sense of they might want to, you know, you say, okay, you've had your turn to run. Now, why don't you stop running so this other guy's program can run? No, I'm not going to stop running. I'm going to use all the resources. Thank you very much. And so they realized, well, we actually need a program which will enforce the rules, which will keep peace, which will keep these programmers from stepping on each other and make sure everyone, not just from stepping on each other, that they don't spend more money than they should. On these systems, everyone would have a quota of how much resources they would have, and it would actually be in dollars and cents. And so when you use the computer, it would actually be billed. And so there had to be a program that made sure you know, when you ran out of money, you didn't get any compute time. Your programs would stop running. That same architecture that was developed to do billing and to make sure and to keep things from crashing is what powers your phones. Same software architecture, same abstractions. Not exactly the same code, but actually not that far from the same APIs. So, 60s. I mean, that's like over 50 years ago. So, you think computer science moves so fast, things keep changing. Oh, it's all different. Not really. That's the lie of computer science. We only really know how to do like 3 or 4 things. And we just keep doing the same things over and over again, giving it new names. So, like, whenever you say, oh, this is a great new programming language, or, oh, isn't this cool how you do this? It's like, look back. Someone probably did that in the 60s. I kid you not. We're horrible. I mean, and in fact, most of what the progress in computer science is that the hardware people keep giving us bigger computers. And thus, they give us a bigger computer, and we're going like, how do we program this and not go insane? That's really what we do nowadays. Because before, they used to say, big programs were 50,000 lines of code. That's a big program. Now, we develop on multi-million lines of codes, and you go like, eh. Google says, oh yeah, you know, Git didn't scale. We had like a couple of billion lines of code. So we modified it to scale up so it would, you know, handle our code. I think, you know, actually Microsoft did the scaling work, but I mean, we're drowning in code. And so most of the work of what computer people, you know, computer scientists do is figure out how do we deal? And operating systems is the key way we deal with it. So I like questions. If you have questions now, go ahead. Otherwise, I'm going to talk about the basic architecture. Questions?
So I said this is what so earlier we were talking about user space, kernel space. Let's talk about that. So the architecture of a modern operating system, you start, of course, there's hardware. Hardware, it's the thing actually doing stuff. And then we have applications. One of these might be Word, one of these might be, you know, Firefox, one of these might be Notepad, you know. They're programs, they're running. Our interest is what's between that and this. You can say the thing in between is the operating system. It's, when you really dig into it, it gets a little bit funny. But the big piece here, the core component of an operating system is known as the operating system kernel.
Now, this is a kernel, the center, the PC bit here.
OS kernel. The OS kernel is the heart of any operating system. There's different styles of kernels. You may have looked at the literature, there's things like microkernels and other things. We'll talk about what those mean in a minute. But the kernel is what makes an operating system a special thing, different fundamentally from regular applications. It's a program. It can be written in almost any language. People normally write in a little other language like C, but they have been written in other things, many other languages.
That's not what's special about it. What's weird about the kernel versus the other program?
kernel allows us to take hardware resources and virtual.
So it provides an abstraction. You know, that's what we're saying. It provides abstraction, one of the things that virtualizes things and stuff. But I'm really thinking about, I mean, that is true, but I'm thinking, what's its relationship? It has, there's something different about it.
Is it the first program that launches?
It is normally the first program that launches. Yes. And that first program that launches implies something very particular. Power. Absolute power. The kernel is the dictator. It is in charge. Every other program on the system runs at the pleasure of the kernel. If the kernel decides you don't belong, you're out of there. So, I mean, the kernels, think of it like a dictator, but a dictator enforcing rules where if you step out of line, you're instantly executed. The classic command in Unix for controlling running programs, i.e. processes. You know what that command is?
Kill.
The program is called kill. And you know why it's called kill? It's because the most common use case of it is to terminate a program. Just go away. So of course, and of course you can do other things with the kill command. It's actually technically used for sending signals to a program. But the most common signal you send to a program is terminate, die. But funnily enough, the die actually has two kinds. There's terminate, and then there's kill. Terminate is, please go and commit suicide. Kill, chop off your head now. You're gone. One, you have time to clean up your affairs and say goodbye. The other, no time to say goodbye. You're gone. So normally you want to terminate programs, not kill them, because people leave their affairs not in order and they die. In fact, same thing with programs. They leave a lot. So you ever seen the thing like force quit? It's a polite way of saying send kill, the kill signal to it. I don't know. Regular people, when they see these words that computer scientists use for these things, they're like, what? Really? Yeah. So the kernel has absolute power. It has absolute power because it came first. It loads first. Now you might say, well, but the kernel then will load other programs. They're all running fundamentally the same code. They're all in machine code at the end of the day. So they're compiled, or maybe they're running different, but it's all code. Why can this code do things the other code can't? It's because the hardware plays favorites. The code that first loads on the system, the hardware is in this mode saying, who's the boss? And the kernel says, I'm the boss. And the moment the kernel says, I'm the boss, kernel is the boss. And no other program can take away that unless the kernel somehow delegates that. And says, nope, they're the boss.
Isn't there a software that's even lower level that, say, you can have Windows or Linux on your computer, but what boots up when you first turn on the computer, say there is nothing?
So this is where we will talk about this. There is, now I said computer scientists don't have any new ideas. They really don't. So when you have a problem and you say, oh, I need a way of starting up the operating system, what should I use? Maybe another operating system. On a modern system, there might be like four operating systems that boot before your main system comes up. I kid you not, because it turns out the modern Intel chips now have a Minix OS somehow in a special supervisor built in, which you can't see, so that is used to initialize the chip. And then once the chip comes up, like you have to run a bootloader, or bootloaders, like little operating systems, or menu loaders, and then let's forget about hypervisors.
So if you're wondering what a hypervisor is, all a hypervisor is a kernel for kernels. It's basically saying, I want to run this kernel, but actually I don't want it to be the boss. I want someone else to be the boss. And I want but the kernel's bossy. The kernel needs to think it's in charge. So you have another boss coming here, the hypervisor. It gets put in there, and the kernel thinks it's running on the hardware, but actually the hypervisor is what booted first. It has control of the hardware, and the kernel gets loaded afterwards, so they're actually running at the mercy of the hypervisor. Think we could do it again? Probably. Probably will within the next decade. I mean, you just keep doing the same thing over and over again. It's just ridiculous.
What's the point of doing that, though,
for
doing the exact same thing
as
the kernels?
Ah. Good question. Why do we keep putting these layers in? The sides of these things, the interfaces provided above and below, are different. This classic kernel is providing an API with Google. Basically, a system call-based API. This is the kind of one that regular applications expect to use. The kernel does not expect to live on a system call type API. It expects to live on hardware. So a hypervisor runs on the hardware, so it uses a hardware API, and provides a hardware-like API. That's all. But layers and layers and layers of software. It's keep saying you can't think about all the layers. You can't even worry about them. You just most of the time you don't have to think about them until they manifest, and then you go, like, oh, that's why. So you try to ignore it as much as you can, but it's ugly. It's really ugly. And I would like to say it's going to get better, but it's not. Because it's all we know how to do. Because that's how we clean up messes. See, that's really what computer science is. We never clean up a mess. What we do is there's a giant messy thing, and we put a big sheet over it. And then we put a sheet over it and say, okay, it's over there, don't worry about it. Or put it in a basket, we pack it away and then say, well, I need to find something in there. And you say, don't look, let me go look, okay? I'll give you what you need. What do you need from it? I'll tell you. Okay, here you go. Here's your shirt. What was it? What else was over there? You don't want to know. That's what we do. Because how else do you deal with a billion transistors? Your phones in your pocket have a billion transistors. The newer ones might have two. That's ridiculous. That's a ridiculous number of transistors. That's what do I do with all these transistors, number of transistors? And that's, in fact, what's happened with computers. We don't know what to do with all the hardware. That's why, all this stuff about AI is so big. AI is wonderful. Partially, that's due to market demand. But also it's due to, we have so many transistors, we don't know what to do with them. What can we throw an infinite number of transistors at and still need more? AI. Gaming worked for a while, but that's kind of petered out. Games are kind of good enough, mostly. Unless maybe you can do a better physics engine, but it's 4K gaming? Really? VR. Okay, we can do more with VR. That'll get you a little bit. But really, as an industry, the computer industry is always looking for the next big thing. And the next big thing is something that actually justifies using more hardware. Because if you can't justify using more hardware, you can't get people to buy more hardware. And that's where everything bottoms out. Because you get new hardware, you have to get new software, and everyone's happy. Who's selling things? We're kind of pathetic that way. So this is a kernel, hypervisors are here. This is kind of the base of the cloud, basically is let people run a bunch of applications, run a bunch of applications in an operating system. I want to run a bunch of operating systems, so I stick one a hypervisor. That's what Google can do. Amazon runs the hypervisor, you get your kernel, you think you have a whole computer, but you don't. So let's talk about what that is. What's that interface to applications? What do applications get from the operating system? Is the door open back there? Can you close the door back there? Sorry. Okay. So what does it mean to talk to the kernel? So what sort of thing would you want to talk to the kernel? Resources, like what?
The rules and sequence to run the thread.
Sorry, what?
Rules and sequence to run the thread.
So threads. So threads is an abstraction for getting access to the CPU. It's like my program's running. I'm running on one core. I want to use four. Right now. Give me threads. Give me four threads. Give me 100 threads. Sure. That's got to run on more cores, right? Maybe not. Up the operating system. But a thread is an abstraction for a program asking for more CPU time. So this is. Actually, really, this is a thread. What about RAM, memory? You know, things like malloc, classic C, everything bottoms out in malloc. Malloc actually uses a system call called break, but we just call it malloc. But what if I want to run a program? What if I want to have like my own little computer? Now, what I mean by that is I want to run a program. On old computers, like growing up, I had an Apple II. This tells you like how old I am. But so I had an Apple II. On an Apple II, the way you ran different programs was you stuck a new floppy disk in it and you turned off the computer and turned it back on and or rebooted. It ran one program at a time. The program had complete control of the hardware. Interestingly enough, when you run a program on any modern system, it actually thinks it has complete control of the entire computer. But the computer it sees is a much nicer computer than the one that really is there. It's much better, it's much nicer, but that it's still kind of like getting your own, I own the whole computer. So the abstraction, so what when I say get your own computer, it's saying a combination of CPU and RAM, that is a process. Specifically, a process is one or more threads plus an address space. Now, this address space concept is a little bit funny one. So in machine code, memory looks like a giant array. It's just bytes in memory at different addresses. Big long array, numbered array. If you're going to run more than one program, how do they number a memory? If one program wants to access memory location 2000, and another program wants to access memory location 2000, what happens? Are they accessing the same memory? Or are they accessing something different? On an older computer, like my Apple II, there was only one address 2000. You access address 2000, it was address 2000. That's why there's only one program, because there was one simple numbering of memory. In a computer today, There is not one simple number in the memory. There's multiple ones. And in fact, it gets kind of crazy complicated, but what it is that there is the actual RAM that has a map of the memory, that's your physical memory, and then every program running on the system has its own numbering. You run one program, it accesses address 2000, another program accesses address 2000, completely different memory. That's called an address space. Address spaces are virtualized. What that means is when you write machine code in a process, you don't have to care what other programs have put in their memory because you can't see them. You have a completely different map of memory. How did you get that another map? Why is it not overlapping with everyone? Who manages that? That's what the kernel does. Does that sound a little complicated? It is. It requires many, many transistors to implement that because it's actually really expensive if you think about it. Every time a program accesses a memory location, that doesn't happen often ever, does it? Every time a program accesses a memory location, the memory location is not really referring to memory. It's a virtual address. It has to be translated at the time of memory access into the physical address, which actually stores the information. That mapping happens on every lookup. So that's the fast path. If you slow that down, you slow the entire computer down. So a ridiculous number of transistors are devoted to doing that. It's the piece of hardware, which is now all in one chip. It used to be a separate chip, an older system. It's called an MMU, Memory Management Unit. And it's responsible for just handling these mappings. So we abstract the CPU into these threads. We abstract memory into these address spaces. And what about the rest? How do I make sure that these things don't talk directly to disks? Well, I kind of chopped off their access because they can't see the real memory. They only, the kernel only lets them see what they want to see, so they can't actually talk to memory. A lot of devices are memory mapped. You talk to them by accessing special memory locations. So they can't even see it. And the other way is they make use of special I/O interfaces on the CPU. So, and those are known as interrupts. We'll talk more about interrupts later. I think I'm getting low out of time. I'm not too bad. Interrupts the other key concept, which is saying, remember how we want to have a program run, but we don't want it just to take run forever? Because when you run a regular application, you have to take over the CPU. Because otherwise, if it was something translating or something, it would slow down it. So you want it to run directly on the CPU. Use full resources. But I don't want to be running there all the time. I need to be able to stop it from running. I need to interrupt it. So all CPUs provide a mechanism to interrupt the currently running program under certain circumstances. All the interrupt is there's certain events that can happen, and there's a place where you can say, what code should I run? This is an address. What code should I run when this event happens? And there's a table, an interrupt table in the CPU, which says what this is. The kernel, because it loaded first, gets to set up the interrupt table, and that's how it maintains control of the CPU. When you generate an interrupt, what sort of things generate interrupts? Some of them are really simple. Things like pressing a key on a keyboard. Something has to pay attention to that. You have to have a message has to go to the CPU and say, oh, someone pressed a key on the keyboard. Or data came in over the network. An interrupt has to happen. Or data's ready from the disk. in our path. So external events, whether directly from a user or from other hardware, have to go to the CPU so that it can interrupt what it's doing and runs the code necessary to deal with that event. So the interrupt handlers can't handle the interrupt.
Be nice if I had my own interrupt handlers. You know, I could like say every time I get asked, some question or something, part of me would just answer that and then immediately return back to where I was. Humans aren't so good at interrupt handling. We tend to lose context. Computers tend to be very good at switching context, dealing with this other task, and then coming back to exactly where they were, remembering the exact state.
One particular kind of interrupt that is useful in building an operating system is a timer interrupt. How do you run more than one program on one core? Set a timer. Say, program A, you run for 100 milliseconds. Go. It runs for 100 milliseconds. Then the timer that was set goes off. And all of a sudden, that program is interrupted. And control is switched back to the kernel. And the kernel says, okay, who do I run next? Now, what if that program didn't want to stop running? What if it said, no, I really just had to finish a couple of more cycles and I would have finished my problem and all done. Nope, you don't get to decide that. You may give a message and say, kernel, can you do a little more? No, you're getting cut off. You will be preempted. But these interrupts, that's what the kernel gets from the hardware. That's not what a regular program is. A regular program has to get something else. And the thing it gets is two things in classic Unix. System calls and signals. Signals are the process level equivalent of interrupts. It's a way for the kernel to send a message to the process saying, hey, something's happened. Now, some of those things are like, okay, time to die. That's a kill signal. But the other signals are more interesting, like, oh, some data showed up.
Or a process that you created to die.
Things that are useful to pay attention to. System calls are how the application asks for other resources. Instead of talking to the disk, instead of talking to the network directly, a process makes a system call and asks the kernel to do something. Is a system call a function call? So, define that. What's a function call in most systems? Function call normally is a jump to a certain memory location, execute some code, and return back to where the call is. Go, and you come back. That's a classic function call. That's what you do in all your major programs. And the names that you use in Java, and JavaScript, and C, or whatever, the names are really representing addresses. It's just pretty simple addresses. Can you just jump to a memory location in order to make the call kernel code? No. Because of that whole thing with memory, I can't even see the kernel's code. I don't know the numbers. I can't call it as a function because I don't know where it is. It's completely opaque to me. All the memory, as far as I can see, is all mine. I don't see the kernel. So instead, I have special instructions which actually generate a kind of interrupt in the hardware level. It's a software interrupt. So this, you get to the interrupt table, making the CPU switch modes, goes into running the kernel, and then runs the and then checks the little process. Oh, you wanted to do this. So I'm going to stop now. And I'm just going to give you all a little bit of time. What I have done just now in the course of the past half an hour or so is given you a broad overview of most of the concepts of an operating system. If you feel a bit lost, that is fine. The way this course is going to be, it's not a linear progression. Really, we're going to be going in circles. We're coming back, we're going to be saying things over and over again. Well, hold on one second, hold on. So if you feel lost, that's okay. I'm just trying to give you an idea of the map of things we're going to talk about, and we'll come back to it. Thank you. See you Tuesday.